everyone, and welcome back to the Developmental Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Ingersoll. Each episode in this podcast, we focus on bringing you interesting interviews with people across a variety of roles in tech. Today's guest entered IT via psychology degree and then has diligently worked his way through the retail industry into C-level roles at several large public companies. Please welcome to the show, Stephen Carvelli.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah, great to have you. Why don't we just jump right in, Stephen, and give us a quick intro as to who you are and kind of walk us through your career path in a bit more detail.
Sure. Thank you, Grant. Well, I got a start in technology in a very unconventional way. As Grant mentioned, I was a psychology major, and in my very first opportunity coming out of school, a little school in Cleveland, Ohio, I had the opportunity to work at a multi-billion dollar public company at the time, Office Max, to be an assistant project manager of a department of two, myself and the manager of the online department. And it was a new fledgling area for the company. So these are the early days of CompuServe, Prodigy, web marketplaces, you know, things that are long forgotten these days. And it was a pretty hard thing to get people to hand you their credit card over the internet in those days. But really, it was an opportunity to be a self-starter in a fledgling area of a business that was a much larger business, one that was not meaningful or creative to the business at the time. But if you could see and have some vision for it and be forward thinking about your career, there was so much opportunity to fully learn all aspects, in my case, of retail as a business, but also all of the modern tech, because it was the area in the business that got to do that work and experiment with it and use it to connect with customers and generate revenue for the company. So you know, just the perfect incubation place to learn a new set of skills and get formal training as well in technology in ways that honestly wouldn't have even been offered in college at that time in traditional computer science programs. Mm-hmm. So it gave me at that point an incredible springboard for everything else I could do in my career, because I now had a grasp on skills that were just emerging as really important, you know, kind of like where artificial intelligence and machine learning would have been just a few years ago. And so that really created all these opportunities for me and my career.
And then so you come out of Office Max, you're a project manager, and then you start working your way up, I guess, through the retail industry. Can you perhaps, you know, kind of get us up to current speed as to where you're at these days and that path you've taken?
Yeah, and I think the way that to your original question, the way that it who I am, right, and the way it developed me, I think, as a person is one of the things that you get out of psychology is that life's all about people, and so a lot of what led me in the rest of my career and all the opportunities was truly the combination of the relationships that you build just naturally and the ones that you build through this incredible opportunity that you have to learn more, which is called projects, right?
Yeah.
You know, even in a continuous delivery world that we live in today, you have these opportunities to deliver full-fledged products in whatever iteration that you do. And when you do that with a group of other people, whether they're remote or there with you in person and co-located, you will develop these trusting relationships just naturally as an outcome of that. And those created incredible opportunities for me the rest of my career. Many of the opportunities I had in my career were with people that I knew or had worked with before. And that's the thing, I think, that you know, became a catalyst for a lot of the opportunities for me in the rest of my career, was just these were trusted relationships that you build, and then you can kind of put it in a different environment and do similar kinds of things. So coming from Office Max, I really needed a formal training and background in project management. I felt like the consultants in those days, it was Capgemini, actually. It was what would eventually become Accenture. And those folks had an incredible set of, I felt, skills or processes to be able to apply to get something from a business concept to a business case, right through visioning for customers to delivery. And I was able to get formal training in that by joining a consulting firm like EDS, Electronic Data Systems, which back in its heyday, you know, was maybe 150,000 consultants, and you know, it was a fairly large organization, and you know, really worked with the most major companies of that day, which you know was General Motors, which they spun off from, and Xerox, and New York Life Insurance Company, covering a lot of different verticals and strategic business units, and worldwide too. So it gave me this incredible exposure where I could work with large clients, but I also was getting a lot of formal training investment in me. So now I could kind of couple that with all that retail experience, all that early technology experience of writing code, of having to do sort of everything from testing through merchandising even of a site, and all the way through the supply chain side of understanding how a retail or hospitality business would work, and combine that with all this formal process training. And those two roles, you know, roughly 3-4 years of my career, became, you know, what I would utilize for all the other roles that I would attempt, right? That combination. And then really starting to gain that understanding that this life is about relationships and about the capabilities, and that you gain from being part of these teams. The teamwork that you do can really sustain you and create so much value, both for you personally as well for the companies that you're working for. So, you know, then held a number of different positions after that, you know, successfully growing in scope, I would say. So the common themes were these were first-time roles. The job description had never existed inside the company before I took on the role. And the job description had, you know, never existed. And they were being born out of disruption, even in those times, of typically digital commerce, or what we now call digital commerce. Back then it was just e-commerce. Right. And an understanding that the way that products and services were going to be delivered and the technology platforms that they would ride on were continuing to evolve at a very fast pace. And so that became just an incredible thing, right? Being able to be the first in a role, there weren't any pre-expectations going in. So I kind of got to drop that. But at the same time, you know, virtually every person in the company would have a different understanding of what exactly your role was, regardless of the description that was there, right? So it's there's two sides to every story, right? And so I had to kind of deal with the, you know, the potential confusion as to, well, how do I fit in, and is this a good thing or is this a threat to my area of the business, right?
Yeah. I find that true a lot with CTOs. In fact, that title in a lot of orgs can mean a lot of different things. And I know you've held that title too. So perhaps, you know, give a little bit more on, you know, I think for most people listening to the show, the idea of being C-level at a publicly traded company is pretty rarefied air. You know, so you work your way up, you know, what's that look like for all of the rest of us who haven't been in that role? What's the day-to-day? Obviously, relationships, I'm sure, are really key. But what else goes into that that makes it, that's a difference maker, if you will, in terms of the way, you know, perhaps anybody below that level thinks about working and the way C-suite members think about working?
You know, I think there's a number of common themes, Grant. And one of them for me was just how much the most senior people that you meet are so open and honestly don't believe they have all the answers, right? It's a mindset that you're never the smartest person in the room, but what makes you savvy and smart and a great leader is that you know that you're not, you're humble enough, and that you really run in that benevolent dictatorship mode. Of, you know, there many of the decisions need to stop with you, and you need to live with the success or the failure of those results, because that's part of the gig. But that remaining very open to outside influence and to the influence of your team, regardless of the level, sometimes way better if you're well lower in the organization, because the closer you are to the customer, or the capability that you're looking to deliver with that end user, you know, the more real you are about what you need to tackle or achieve. And you can get so caught up in strategy that you lose track of what's actually meaningful and you can miss the mark. So I think those people, you know, have these wide visions in these roles, but they do it in such a way that they don't forget, you know, who it is that gets to judge whether it's successful or not at the end of the day, besides, of course, the investors in your business themselves. And really, you know, are open to hearing fresh new ideas and constantly out looking on the horizon for what's coming. And while at the same time having to deliver current day business results, right? Yeah. You've got to execute, you got to be able to deliver. And I think most of the folks that I've met, other than myself, right, my peers I've worked with over the years, CEOs, CMOs, all kinds of different corporate roles, general counsels, you name it, they all were, I think, smart enough and savvy enough to grab themselves a mentor along the way, if not many. So they read a lot about these things. They read, they're always looking to improve themselves, and mentorship's an incredible incubator for that, in that they look to learn from others one way or another. If they get to know you on a personal level, they want to learn from you. If they have to read your book, they want to learn from you. Because maybe you don't get to meet Warren Buffett, but they're just very strong learners. And, you know, they're very heavily influenced by people like Jim Collins, you know, with books like Good to Great and Built to Last. And, you know, you'll see those themes come up. I was actually just watching the other day, a Fortune 40 company, and it was their annual meeting, very large, Las Vegas based. And there were so many Jim Collins references in the speech and on the board that I saw. You know, it was just, you know, you have to be open to those kind of influences and make them your own and turn them into your own capabilities. And I think that's been something that was very lucky for me. I got handed a book from Larry Bosty called Execution about midway through my career. You know, I was a director at that point. And it made a profound difference for me in how I thought about, you know, employees working for me, who, how to select the right employees, who to spend time with and promote, and what the basis should be, besides the obvious of, you know, culture and how you treat people, which is number one. And I think it really just helped me to remember, like, what are we here for? What do our investors expect from us? What do our peers expect from us? And that, you know, truly being able to execute is at the end of the day, incredibly important, and do it in a way in which you can leave a trail of connection, partnership, and to the extent possible, I mean, true friendship behind. You know, you get so much out of your career. You only get to do this once, as far as I know, and it's incredibly important that you take the time to acknowledge the people around you and enjoy what you've been able to accomplish together. And it's so hard when it's always on to the next thing and the next quarter and the next annualized goals and what have you. You can lose track of it. And, you know, you could lose track of yourself in the process. But I think those senior executives, they share this uncanny capability to just be honestly great listeners. And you know, they're not always this chattiest person in the room, like people like myself tend to be. They're you know, very rarely the loudest voice in the room. And in a way, that's actually more commanding, right?
Yeah, speak softly, carry a big stick, right?
Speak softly and carry a big stick. I mean, I've seen some of the most senior people come off so incredibly humble, you'd hardly believe it. And, you know, for me, you know, some of those other influences, you know, people like General Colin Powell, and I read his book and got to meet him in person. It was just very, very powerful for me. In the way that he led within our military forces. So these influences come from a lot of different places. And, you know, notice I'm not talking about the technology much right now, and we're all about technology, right?
Yeah. This is definitely a consistent theme in all the interviews I've done so far on this podcast, is here. I even coming into these conversations, like, let's talk about careers in tech, and it would be tech, and that's what we'd be talking about. And everybody to the T is let's talk about relationships, because that's really what matters in your career.
Yeah, it truly is. And what you find is that, to that point, Grant, before we move on, I think it's just incredible. Take nothing away from this conversation is that you care for those relationships. Yeah. You know, I honestly believe the most successful people that I've seen in my career, you know, very, very high percentage of the time, have paid very, very close relation, very close attention to those relationships and how important they're going to be in their career. And it's not always the people with the fanciest title and the biggest paycheck and all that kind of stuff. It's you don't know what's where someone's going to go in their career. You meet some of the smartest people who just haven't gotten there yet. Yeah. And you know they will be, and you need to learn from them and you need to enjoy them for what they are, and you will be talking to them and seeing them again. I think that's what the perspective of time can give you.
Interesting. Well, and I think there's an interesting underlying theme here too, because I think one of the challenges we all often face as we grow in our career is this movement from individual contributor to management, and this shift where, you know, I mean, effectively what I'm hearing you say is, you know, as an individual contributor, sure, you're obviously still building relationships and things like that, but you're expected to be the one talking in the sense that you're the one, you know, quote unquote, doing the work. And then when you shift into these leadership roles, it's, you're obviously still doing the work, but it's much more this, I need to gather facts. And those facts are often filtered through a lot of different layers, especially at a big company like some of the ones you've worked at. And you have to be able to make a decision based off of how well you can listen and gather facts and develop these relationships of trust. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, it's you know, it's a good news, bad news story in today's day and age, I think. I think the good news is you can be an incredibly high-level IC and not have to actually address that part of your career. You could have, you know, the biggest paycheck you could ever imagine and the fanciest title at an Amazon or some big tech company. And honestly, you still need to have these partnerships. You still need to have these relationships, but you can probably get away with some things and just be super technical, right? Yeah. Because of the white papers you produce and the thought leadership. Yeah. The vast majority of roles though, I would say that, you know, more and more and more, it sways to the other side as you move up in your career. And there is, I always felt like, and for others when I talk to them, there is that kind of inflection point where you first move into those roles and you realize just how different it is, right? Yeah, you no longer can do that work. You have to actually rely on others. And you can't guarantee the output of their work. But what you can do is create a nurturing, you know, environment where that work has the best chance of getting completed and done in the way that you thought. So letting go is an incredibly hard thing if you've been really, because most of the time you've received the opportunity initially in those early management roles because you were so good as an IC. You delivered, you were so smart, you had all these great technical ideas and you were able to execute. That doesn't naturally mean you're going to make a great leader, right? And we've all seen it in our careers. I know you have in yours, Grant. And we've seen people try to force themselves into management roles so they can kind of climb a corporate ladder thing and just total abject failure and have to back away from it, actually. So I guess my biggest sort of tip there is to just say, know that when you've hit that inflection point, you're going to need different thoughts and influences than you needed to get you to where you are. In other words, the what got you here won't get you there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, let's shift gears a little bit. I mean, I think that's really great. There's so much in there in terms of building relationships. And it sounds like at the end of the day, that really is probably the skill most needed at the level we're talking about here, right? So good project management, good grasp of the technology, but at the end of the day, that ability to work with and influence people, I think sounds like a really key part of that.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever see a billion or a multi-billion dollar project fail over the course of a few years, total fail, and you decompose sort of what went wrong, it comes back to some of the things that we've talked about.
Yeah.
It's very rarely that it was the technology would never work kind of thing, right?
Right. I always liken it to, I'm a bit of a sports junkie, and those dream teams that always fail, right? Like when they've got all of their star-studded team, they've signed all the big contracts, and then they don't win the championship. It's almost always because there's relationship issues, right? There's locker room issues. There's distrust for each other on the team. And then those teams that win that were the underdogs, there's almost always a chemistry there that can't be accounted for on the stat sheet, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
True in business too.
Very true in business. And in fact, I've actually, on the formal training side, a number of times in my career on the leadership training side, that exact example, of you could have individuals that on their own or even in a different team environment were absolute superstars, the best, the top of the top, but if put together and those pieces aren't in place, all the wrong things can happen. So that's a real example. It gets used a lot because it's easy to kind of digest, but it's a really good one because it's exactly what happens in this real world setting.
You know, Stephen, you mentioned, kind of as you were getting started, you really dug in on this project management side. And I think you also hinted at, you learned to code along the way. What was your process? So you've got this psychology degree, and then are you all self-taught on those things? You mentioned obviously EDS, and you learned good, solid consulting project management there. Where and how did you learn to code and really get to a point where you felt comfortable with the technology?
In the early stages, there was a combination. It was everything from, I'm not kidding, I was hanging out in the other side of the IT department with the SQL development team and learning whatever I could learn to formal training classes from some of the major platforms that we were on around CGI scripting and Java and HTML to, I was working an 80-hour work week and no kidding, teaching myself in the evenings. And then next thing you know, I was building websites on the side for Turner Network Television for specials they were doing on everything from sports to whatever, in addition to doing my day job.
Wow.
And because I just had such a crazy passion for it, right? If you're a learner and explorer, I think there's so much available to you. And, all joking aside, back in the day, I used to go into a Barnes & Noble and pick out a book and read it too. So there was some absolutely great software development books that have been written over the years on all the major languages. And, I found that was really helpful as well. So I'd say it was kind of a combination of a lot of informal and then a lot of formal too. When I got to EDS, I would take, SQL classes from Oracle directly. I would take, if it was project management, it was from whoever the best was there. I mean, the great thing about being with a consulting firm is that they will make an investment in you typically.
Yeah. And I would imagine too, like you get exposed to so many different lines of business when you're in a consulting firm.
Yeah. I mean, you do so many different, verticals, right, as we would call them. So whether it's healthcare or financial services or retail or hospitality, which, were the majority that I kind of ran into, life sciences. I mean, you really do. And when you go to train, you train with people who are from those other areas. I was in with an airplane manufacturer. I remember for 2 weeks together in training classes and, in between the activities that you do and even having lunch and dinner together, you learn so much just in even those short periods of time when you're interacting with these folks. So again, kind of keeping that learner attitude and that open mind. I don't know how you can work in technology, although there's lots of people that do, and it always kind of blows my mind, and stop learning.
Yeah. Right? I have the same reaction. You meet these people who it's like, okay, I've learned all the way up to this point. I love technology, but only to this point. And I'm like, there's new ways to do things. Like,
And you have to help. You can consult on COBOL and mainframe for the rest of your life. And maybe you'll be able to, because we have an incredibly bad habit of not getting off old tech. But it's incredible, right? It's really, really incredible. And honestly, to make a living out of just staying with legacy tech for their entire career, because certain less forward-thinking companies just get stuck on it.
Yeah, well, like there's whole businesses, right, that just buy up all the old software and then maintain it for the rest, as long as they can milk those support contracts, right?
Yeah, no names. There was a big one that just recently happened with a major e-commerce platform, too, and you probably know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's so true. I think one of the things with this developmental podcast, you know, two things really emerging from everyone I talk to: relationships and always learning. So if people take away nothing else, that's one of the keys here. Let's shift gears a little bit and talk, kind of what's facing the modern CIO or CTO, especially, you know, in public facing companies. What do you see as, you know, you've been in, and for some very large multinational, big brand name companies, what are the key challenges that folks in those roles are facing these days?
You know, it's funny. It actually goes a little bit back to our earlier conversation about what you do early in your career around learning, going after new things, somewhat taking more risks. You become adverse to it, I think, in a lot of cases when you get in these higher level roles. And in today's day and age, that's the worst thing that you can do. Because the CIO role, CTO role, you know, CTO role was the infrastructure guy back in the day, or gal,
yeah.
whoever was going to occupy that role. So, you know, that particular man or woman was incredibly challenged with, you know, just worried about keeping the lights on and operating in the background where no one was looking and keeping costs down. Well, that infrastructure job is an incredibly forward-thinking role now, right? And the CTO role has been pretty much completely rethought of as across the entire enterprise. And, you know, typically an average corporation runs enterprise architecture, drives an incredible amount of key decision-making around process and where the company is going to go. So, and it's, you know, really taken on a different role if there is a CIO in the company and sort of the relationship with that person. And the CIO's role, you know, the transformation is these are no longer the equivalent, I would say, of, let's say, a somewhat siloed, you know, legal role, right? And that's nothing against the best lawyers I've worked with over the years. But you are expected to be a higher level business person now.
Yeah.
And it's not good enough to say, you make widgets and it's okay because, you know, you're the person who runs the ERP system and keeps security quiet. And that'll earn you a paycheck every week. It's not good enough anymore.
Right.
You have got to be finding new and innovative ways to not only gain productivity on all back office activities and have your employees in the company at any level feel supported, but also provide customer facing in most cases and associate facing who serve directly your customers capabilities that are at the level that people experience when they pick up their iPhone. And if you can't keep up with how technology companies have transformed the way that we all experience the digital world and communicate, you're at risk of losing your customers because their belief is that you don't understand their business anymore and what their day-to-day life and challenges are like. And so the CIO is now playing this really key at the table with the rest of the executive team role in driving the business. And it's not good enough to just have a great perspective on tech or a great capability. They're expected to have capabilities and opinions that rival that of a chief operating officer, of a CEO, real P&L understanding of the customer and the business, and to be able to bring thought leadership. And that was not something CIOs traditionally were being asked to do, right? They had a bit more of a quiet role at the table, maybe a backseat at the board meeting. It's just not that way anymore. And so who actually occupies the CIO seat is changing as a result.
Well, it's funny. I think people of a certain age that, you know, there's still a lot of talk about business and technology, right? Like there are two, there's the business side of the house and the IT side of the house. And when I look at, like, for instance, my son growing up, or any of the digital natives, if you will, or any company that's gone through a well-done digital transformation, to use a current industry trend, those lines are gone. There is no business and IT. It's all together. Your business leaders are more tech savvy than they've ever been, and your tech people are more business savvy than they've ever been. So I think you're dead on there, and that those distinctions are going the way of the dodo, as they say, right?
Yeah, and I think the ball's coming to the technology team, in the sense that I literally had this conversation last night with someone in the Fortune 100 who's been displaced as a more traditional chief digital officer, because they were not technology knowledgeable and oriented enough. And are being replaced by somebody who has a very strong background in both the business, but really in software development and all product management, which used to be quote unquote the business, is collapsed underneath the technology team, so that you have full integration between those functions. And that technology leader is responsible for, you know, the growth or shrink that happens within that business unit. So essentially they are the CDO. The CIO is, you know, seen often where CIOs now have a combo title: CIO, CDO, CIO, chief of strategy. You know, these are just different roles now. And then I've seen a number of CIOs move into other roles as a result, as chief operating officers or what have you, because of the skills acquired through running large scale technology operations. You know, in one example, it was a company is a large provider of private airplanes, you know, the equivalent of like a NetJets. Mm-hmm. And so this person's technology operations experience was a direct transfer in their minds, plus the leadership skill sets, to running flight-based operations worldwide for this company that has planes all over the world. And then running that actual operations center is so key, plus the P&L experience of operating the business, was a natural thing for the CIO to move into a chief operating officer role. I mean, that was not something you would have seen 15 years ago, 10 years ago.
Well, I mean, the CDO role didn't even exist, you know, 15, 20 years ago, right? I mean, it kind of was there maybe in some forward-thinking companies, whereas now you see that almost everywhere you go, right?
That's why it was surprising to see, you know, a CDO in such early stages who had the experience of been delivering somewhat displaced based on technical skill, basically, after years of delivering double-digit positive growth for a business. I mean, it just tells you the expectations are continuing to evolve, and having a multidisciplinary background is going to be really, really key to being successful long-term. And I believe the same thing will happen on the machine learning and AI side, right?
Yeah.
You're going to have to be able to do both.
Yeah. Well, and also I think I always talk about AI and UI, right? Like you have to have the smarts around the machine learning, but you better be able to deliver it in a way that is consumable by everyday people, right? You can't sit and talk TensorFlow and things like that. You've got to be able to show people what are the results of it, right?
And actually absolutely
get it off.
And it's hard. I mean, let's face it, it's hard sometimes to switch gears from you're at the whiteboard and you are talking TensorFlow with very highly technical people, and you walk out of that room and the next meeting is a completely different business orientation meeting about the output of those capabilities, right?
Yeah.
So I think having that, starting to learn those skills, you know, early in your mid-career, to be flexible, to move back and forth on settings that you're going to be sitting in within the business, I think is going to be really key for a lot of executives in the future. Yeah. So I think it's a good, tip for early in your career, you know, beyond the things we've talked about around relationships. And you know, we haven't talked a lot of tech, but there's no question that you have to continue to be forward thinking about the technology and stay current and relevant. I've seen many folks just get replaced because they just didn't keep learning.
Yeah.
And it's an environment where you have to just keep evolving, like we've talked about earlier. So really important skills to be able to develop earlier in your career that you probably aren't even thinking about how they're going to all pay off, but they do.
Yeah. That's where I know I have a liberal arts background, and I think part of that was just, you know, it forces you to think about lots of different things. And I think that's paid off well. Let me finish up with, maybe two more questions. And one, you've been in retail for a long time and there's a lot of companies out there shuttering their doors. I think I just saw today yet another large national brick and mortar, I think shoe company, announcing they're closing a bunch of stores. People love to blame Amazon, but it's interesting to me, plenty of other companies have really survived and even thrived in the post Amazon world. And I know you've got a lot of experience here. What really separates out the haves and have nots in retail these days in your mind?
Yeah, I think for whatever reason, whether it's a major technology company, whether it's friends and colleagues, I probably have this conversation once a day.
Yeah. And, now you can be on the record with it.
Yeah. And I think you'd agree, Grant, you don't have to be an expert to understand the fundamentals of it, right? I honestly believe that. I think you just have to be a consumer, right? And in this case, I think a consumer in the United States, if we're kind of keeping it to us.
Yep.
We're not going to stop shopping. We're consuming sort of more than ever. At least that's what credit card debt tells us.
Yeah.
But we just do it differently. And what's really challenging, I think you were referencing the shoe business. I know a little bit about that business. I know people have worked for that business. But, Zappos has been around for a while. It's been a long time since even Nordstrom launched NordstromShoes.com, which was, I'm not kidding, I think it was in the late 90s, like 97, 98, maybe 99. And the shoe business has transformed a bit in how people, feel about ordering online and getting delivery of shoes versus having to try it on in person. So, there's no excuse for not evolving from the late 90s to now,
yeah,
in my opinion. And I think what happens is you have thinking that it's, again, what got you here won't get you there. It got you to a certain point. You don't see what's on the horizon. You're not taking the time to think forward, or you're not sure how to pivot to it. And then I think there's some real world challenges for physical retail. You've made large capital investments in thousands of locations.
Yeah.
Simple example, digital shelf labels are incredible now. Having been to the National Retail Federation conference at the Javits Center earlier in the year, no plug for NRF there, but the digital shelf label technology is incredible. I mean, it's really, really impressive. You can do so much with it. It's so helpful for stockouts, for inventory. If you think about a retail business, the tech is perfect, actually. The challenge is that to go back to every major shelf in thousands and thousands of locations and to make a transference of that capability, plus the teams to operate it, plus the new operating processes and the way everyone needs to be retrained in the store, it's incredibly difficult to make an investment in a quarter by quarter retail environment with low margins to make that transformation. The truth is, it would be easier to start a new business that does things that way from scratch and start building store by store with the initial capital investment. And I think that's some of what you're going to see as these things transform. You're going to see some, I believe you will start to see more online businesses start to have physical locations, but those physical locations will be very different from the last round of physical locations within that vertical or subvertical.
Amazon's opening stores. It's funny how much this all parallels Sears from 100 years ago, right? They were catalog only, and then they started opening stores. And what comes around goes around, as we've seen. They've just more or less shuttered themselves as well. So,
yeah, if the internet's taught us anything beyond the information age itself, it's that convenience is king. Yeah. And convenience still includes, I'm driving by right now and want to pick something up.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
I think the retail apocalypse, as we've been deeming it, is very real, but from the sense that it's a little bit of innovate or die. Right.
Right. You'll start seeing those brick and mortar stores start acting as mini warehouses and things like that, and then doing, you know, near field delivery, I suspect.
Right. We've seen Walmart's commercial push over the Super Bowl and post then. I mean, I'm sure it was not inexpensive to to hire all those movie references so that they can make their point that you can actually order online and pick up or have delivered if you choose. But, you know, really their pickup business is huge. Why? Because there's a Walmart everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's convenient. And therefore, what's more convenient than going into the store, driving by the store and never getting out of your car? That's more convenient.
Yeah.
Going to a locker and picking it up at oddball times of the day. And that's what we're seeing, right? It's just a very natural thing. We're treating it like it's something unnatural. But I think it's a very natural thing of evolution of we all have these supercomputers in our pockets now, and it makes it really, really easy to do things because of all the capabilities of those Android and Apple phones. So,
yeah.
Those mobile devices have created a new level of convenience that we all have to kind of tap into. And there'll be a lot of failures along the way. I don't want to name any of them right offhand, but you're going to try some things and fail, and money will get spent and fail. And the reality is, that's how you learn. You learn through failure. We all do as human beings. You and I, Grant, are no different. If you were having a podcast on that, it'd probably take a couple hours.
Maybe we'll do a whole episode on career failures. I probably could just do that. I know I could cover plenty with my own career. That's for sure.
Yeah. Don't play scared. That would be my number one thing there. Right. Like you're going to fail one way or another. So just enjoy the ride and take that failure, learn from it, and let it lead to your successes, because it does. So
I think you probably just answered the question I ask every guest as a final one, which is, as you wrap it all up and you look at your career today, you know, what are some of the key takeaways and pieces of advice you would give to somebody who wants to take that similar path?
Yeah, I think, and I've seen this of others in my career, I think since you're doing a great series here, I think you'll probably get a lot of similar type answers. But I'm going to kind of go a little different direction because I think it's important to keep in mind too. And you probably won't get this one again, but I do think know when it's time to. So when you're in a role in an organization, even if you're working independently, know when it's time to make your next transition. And it'll never feel incredibly comfortable. It's probably the best time when it doesn't feel comfortable. You'll always feel like, whether you admit it or not, you're nervous or scared to leave something behind, or that things were so steady or stable in your life that what are you about to do to yourself because you're failing in the next situation. I think that's just natural human behavior. I don't care what level you're at. But I also think for the explorers in the world, those are the most exciting times because you honestly don't know what comes next. And in that way, it can be really exciting because the possibilities are endless. And get excited about those endless possibilities. It goes back to the tech again too, right? The best technology individuals I've met over the years don't do anything like they used to do it 2 years ago or 3 years ago because they continue to evolve. And they're more excited today about what's coming forward than they were about the things they worked on yesterday. And they never spend too much time dwelling on that one little great thing that they did. They move directly on to the next thing and keep pushing forward because that's what drives them. And I believe that's why they're successful because the concrete that their feet are in, it never gets dry. We just keep moving. So that would be my greatest piece of advice, I think, is just take the time to know when it's time to make your next career decision, when it's time to make a move to maybe it's something that makes you uncomfortable, but you know will make you better. And it'll be scary and you won't always be successful with it, but keep pushing forward. It's worth it. And you find generally when you talk to these folks who hopefully you get as mentors in your career, and if you ask them, have you had failures in their career? I mean, it'll take some time. You'll be surprised at the answer that you get. I was even reading something about Mark Cuban the other day and just the number of things that have gone wrong for him in his own development, in his career, but how much it led to the things that made him very successful in his career. So that's my great piece of advice. And I'm guessing, Grant, you'd probably agree with that one too.
Yeah, it's wow. I wasn't actually expecting that. That is a great piece of advice. And I think it goes back to what you hit on earlier as perhaps a way to wrap all of this up, which is, you know, having that openness to new ideas.
And it sounds trivial or something very easy to do. It's actually not easy to do because we're all creatures of habit and we get stuck and it worked once, it'll work again over and over again. Well, you know, retail to some extent, you know, drawing a parallel back to that and that conversation that we had, that's kind of the mistake, right? The what got you here truly won't get you there. Don't be deceived by the past success you've had. Yeah.
So very good, Stephen. I think I could continue this conversation for another hour, but I do want to wrap this up. This has been so insightful. I think our listeners will be really interested in hearing about all the different things that parts of your career. So I just want to thank you for taking the time for joining me today.
Thank you, Grant. And, you know, first and foremost, have fun. Life's short.
Awesome. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Grant. Have a good one.